This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector. Investigative conversations about issues that impact our lives. Be curious. Friday mornings at 9 a.m. only on 101.9 Chai FM.
And this is indeed The Deep Dive, and I am your host, Spector. And today we're going to be doing a twofer. We're going to have two separate conversations. They're not exactly going to overlap, and that may be the joy of it. The first half of our hour, we're going to talk to David Smith, a man we like to go to help us understand the intricacies and the inanities and the zaniness and the profundities of American politics and life. David, as many of you know, was the Guardian correspondent in Africa for a number of years, where we got to know him. And he subsequently moved to Washington, D.C. And he's been there for some years, and he is now deeply ensconced in the ways of Washington. But we're talking to him from Des Moines, Iowa. And the reason for that, I'm going to ask him in a second, but the two topics I hope he can talk to us about. One is the effect and the passing of the one big beautiful bill, which was not an invoice but something else, and the other was the after effects of the bunker busters and how that's going to play out in Washington. But David, you're in Des Moines, Iowa, and it's probably not to sample the corn dogs or to look at the giant cow made out of butter or anything else like that.
You're referring to the Iowa State Fair, which happens next month and is this grand occasion in Iowa with lots of deep fried food and milk and cookies. The Iowa State Fairgrounds, I wandered through them tonight, and they were in action hosting Donald Trump for what in theory was the kickoff of a year-long celebration of America's 250th anniversary of independence, the semi-quincentennial, however, potentially a moment of unity. However, in practice, Trump turned it into a typical campaign rally, mocking Joe Biden's speech style and berating the media and various other foes and enemies, talking about how he hates Democrats, getting trouble for using the word Shylocks to describe bankers, which some see as anti-Semitic, and above all, trumpeting his new One Big Beautiful Bill, the sweeping legislation passed by Congress he thinks is going to make America great again.
I haven't heard the word Shylock in political discourse for a really long time. It goes back, Shakespeare used it, but that's often a trigger for a discussion about its deeper meaning.
Joe Biden used it in 2014 when he was vice president and had to apologize. The Anti-Defamation League finds it anti-Semitic. Trump said later he didn't know about this association. And I can believe the defense that he does not know who or what Shylock is, and he's never seen The Merchant of Venice. That I do find credible.
Oh, okay. I'll give you a point on that one. I'm not so sure, but you know about him well enough to know that he often uses trigger words and then denies the obvious implications or ramifications of the word. I never knew anything about it. It wasn't me. And off we go again on another weird tangent. The crowd responded wildly and enthusiastically, or they looked stunned and confused?
Oh, they were wild and enthusiastic throughout this entire hour-long speech as Trump ricocheted from topic to topic. They were chanting USA, USA, and dressed in Make America Great Again caps. And the ones I interviewed say they think he's doing a fantastic job as president.
We're going to take a quick break for commercial messages, and we'll be right back. And I want you to tie, when we come back, can you tie this rally stroke kickoff of the semi-quincentennial. I had to learn that word recently, as I guess many people have had to, at how that's going to play out over the next year.
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back live, and I am indeed Brooke Spector. My guest today, or one of my two guests, David Smith, the Guardian correspondent in Washington, but now broadcasting to us from Des Moines, Iowa, where he has been with Donald Trump, extolling all manner of things. But I gather that Mr. Trump is going to leave Iowa, or perhaps already has, to go back to Washington to have a great ceremony of signing his one big, beautiful bill, this massive tome of a law that covers changes in tax policies, changes in government spending, changes in government orientations. And I am willing to bet that very few of the 535 people in Congress ever read it. And a little bit more than half of them voted for it. What does this say about the way the government is functioning now, with a what can only be described as a fairly supine Congress?
Yes, I think we are in the imperial presidency, and there's some irony of Donald Trump kicking off America's 250th birthday celebrations, celebrating independence from King George of Britain, but some would argue Trump is becoming a bit of a monarch himself, and you saw how Congress rolled over on his signature legislation here, the so-called One Big Beautiful Bill. Its contents are very controversial. It extends his tax cuts from 2017. It adds hundreds of billions of dollars in funding to the defense and border security, but at the same time, really slashes health insurance, the Medicaid program, also cuts into food stamps, raises the prospect of children going to school hungry, and it phases out clean energy tax credits. So it's a blow to the fight against the climate crisis. On top of all of that, it adds nearly $3.3 trillion to the deficit over a decade, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. And that's one of the reasons Elon Musk, among others, was opposed to it. And in the last few weeks, many Republicans have raised concerns, voiced dissent, threatened to vote it down. And yet, when it came to the crunch in the last few days, racing for this symbolic July the 4th deadline, nearly all of them folded. And I think there's two reasons for that. One is Trump is still the utterly dominant figurehead of the Republican Party. They did not dare defy him. Those who did or threatened to would face a Trump-backed primary challenger for their seat in the next election. They'd also get insults and a generally hostile atmosphere from Trump's base. And secondly, these Republicans knew that the one thing worse than passing this bill would be not passing it, because that would be politically disastrous. They would face their own voters in next year's midterms empty-handed. The tax cuts from Trump would no longer be in place. So they had to avoid that fate, and they bowed to the inevitable. But if you listen to Democrats, they're saying this bill is the worst they've ever seen in their lives. It's the biggest ever transfer of wealth from the middle and working class to the wealthy and corporations. And they're using words like obscene and disgusting and Robin Hood in reverse.
I have this sort of nightmarish vision of the little match girl standing outside the restaurant in the snow, trying desperately to warm her fingers with one match at a time, while inside the wealthy are having a six-course banquet with all the beverages that go with it, and congratulating themselves for having made this great achievement. The question is this going to redound to the detriment of incumbent congressmen and women who voted for it come the midterm election, when its provisions are actually clearer in the minds of people who suddenly no longer have their Medicaid, or the food stamps weren't distributed, or the rural hospital was closed because of a lack of a government subsidy. How is that going to play out, do you think?
Yeah, I think it will harm Republicans. I mean, just to your first point, when I was based in South Africa, I would often write about South Africa as being the most unequal society in the world. But today, America might have taken a giant leap towards claiming that crown, or at least running South Africa close. This, by all accounts, is going to really deepen and exacerbate American inequality and take away the social safety net, in fact, for many of Donald Trump's own voters. And yes, I think there will be a political price to pay. Now, again, a few hours ago in Iowa, Donald Trump actually said at one point, you know, this bill is so great and it's going to make America the strongest economy in the world and so on. We should talk about it in the midterm elections. You know, he has that much confidence. But I know for sure Democrats are definitely going to talk about it. They think this is a big vote loser for Trump and the Republicans. For the reasons you say, when rural hospitals close, when people can't get their food stamps, when children are struggling in school because they've got an empty stomach, when people are kicked off their health insurance, and there are estimates that could affect about 17 million people, they are going to ask, you know, who's to blame for this? Who's got the blood on their hands? And Republicans lined up and voted this through. And I think very quickly we will see Democrats try to exploit this politically and get the word out, and basically say to voters, you should make Republicans pay the price. Vote us in. We will try to do something about it.
I mean, pretty much up until the bill was passed, the Democrats seemed to have, on the whole, a confusing set of messages. It was not entirely clear what Democrats stood for anymore, other than opposing some of Donald Trump's worst excesses, or presumed worst excesses. And let's, after this next break, let's talk about that a little bit. How should the Democrats respond, and in what manner bring their notably fissiparious party back in some semblance of coherence and unity?
This is The Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
Now we're back, and we are indeed The Deep Dive, and I'm your host, Brooke Spector. My guest, one of my two guests today, David Smith, Washington correspondent for The Guardian, but temporarily housed in a hotel room in Des Moines, Iowa, where he has been following Donald Trump on his peregrinations around the country, touting the success of his one big, beautiful bill, now one big, beautiful law, I guess, that did all the things we just went through. But the United States obviously has more than one political party, although sometimes it's a little hard to tell. The Democrats have to respond to this in some way, because inevitably there's an election coming up in a year and a few months for Congress, much of the Senate. How can they bring themselves together? To discern a clear message from Democrats has been almost impossible over the last number of months. They're all over the landscape, let's put it that way. Everything except "we like Donald Trump" has been their message. That's clear. But what do they do now?
Yeah, it is a messy party with lots of different people saying lots of different things. And it feels quite leaderless and rudderless at the moment. There's no one focusing its message apart from, as you say, we are the anti-Trump party. I would say what was interesting in the past couple of weeks was, first, the Democratic primary election for mayor of New York, which was won by Zoran Mamdani, self-declared democratic socialist, so very much a figure of the left. I think what you saw there was a potential blueprint for Democrats. Certainly, in some ways, he married, good old-fashioned shoe leather campaigning. He was out on the streets meeting people with great social media savvy, very scrollable videos, very humorous, very catchy, big on TikTok. This included him just going upstate with a microphone, interviewing people in New York. Why did you vote for Donald Trump last November? It also included him running into a cold ocean, wearing a suit with bare feet to make a point of, and then coming up with some bad puns about freezing rents. And it was catchy. It was, he was young, charismatic. He was very much of New York, a cosmopolitan figure. But perhaps most importantly in all of that, his he had a relentless focus on the affordability crisis in New York, the most expensive city in America. People now really struggling to buy a house or rent an apartment. The average rent there is $5,000 a month. Struggling to pay bills, struggling to pay school fees, and so on. And some of his solutions were free bus services, and more taxes on the rich, and improved childcare, and so on. By the way, some of the policies in Europe would be regarded as mainstream. In America, they're seen as Marxist or communist. But anyway, I thought it was interesting. A few days later, I went to an event in Washington with Senator Elisa Slotkin of Michigan, who at first glance has very little in common with Mamdani. She's much more of a moderate, a centrist. She's in a Midwestern state. But where she overlapped with him and had common cause was this issue of affordability. She said, she used to work for the CIA and the Pentagon, and the biggest national security threat to the United States is not an external foe. It's actually the shrinking middle class. An entire generation of people who feel their children are going to be worse off than they are, difficulty of buying a house, and so on. And you could see the beginnings, maybe, of a direction for the Democrats, just a laser-like focus on affordability and cost of living. And I think they would say Republicans have handed them a political gift in the last 24 hours with this bill, because it's all about exacerbating inequality and giving tax cuts to the rich, and so on. That will be interesting to follow. But sure, I mean, Democrats still have a long way to go, and we still don't know who their next presidential nominee is going to be, what direction the party's going to take, and obviously, someone like Mamdani is easy for Republicans to cast as a radical leftist and paint the party in that way.
Yeah, I mean, uncharitable folks would probably sum up Mamdani's views and several others as sort of eat the rich politics rather than solve problems as they really are. And yet it always confounds me because the Democrats have a whole clutch of thoughtful, articulate, coherent governors scattered across the country in big and small states, all of whom know what they're doing and manage to do it pretty well. They're just not in the national limelight in quite the same way. They haven't seized the media to make themselves an obvious contender, and that's interesting. We have just a couple of minutes, but talk to me just briefly about the after effect of not the budget buster, but the bunker busters. That was good, wasn't it?
And Trump talked about that at his rally in Iowa as well. He is still insisting that Iran's nuclear facilities were obliterated, which some intelligence reports have thrown into question. But I think, Trump at the White House, they're pretty upbeat and buoyant about a lot of these domestic issues, the bill, jobs numbers, and so on. But also internationally, they think Iran went well for them. This attack on the nuclear facilities. People were saying, "Oh, this is the start of World War III or a George Bush style entanglement." And At his rally, Trump recounted how the Iranians actually got in touch with him, he says, and advised him, we have to hit back. We're going to attack your US military base in Qatar, but what time shall we do it? And we're giving you warning so that people can take cover. And Trump said they sounded a little bit nervous about it. So it was a sort of symbolic response from Iran. And that was it. So, he's claiming victory for a ceasefire between Iran and Israel. And it feels in Washington, that issue is fading away again now. But we do have Benjamin Netanyahu coming to the White House on Monday. There'll be talk of Gaza then. Trump also, claiming another win in terms of NATO and countries with their spending. But, it's not going quite so well with Russia and Ukraine. He had an hour-long call with Vladimir Putin and made very little progress in that war, which continues. But I think right now he's feeling good about Iran, that in his view, its progress towards a nuclear weapon was set back significantly, and there was very little price to pay for that.
So, at least from the Republicans' perspective, Donald Trump's sun is still on the ascendancy as opposed to setting. Although any number of the things that you just, that whole list of things you mentioned, any one of them could go sour quickly in a way which would turn the tables, flip the dial, do some sort of thing to make it very, very different. But at least as right now. He's in, as sports broadcaster Mel Allen used to say, he's sitting in the catbird seat.
The
That dates me a lot, doesn't it?
I mean, the messaging from Trump and his aide Stephen Miller is this has been the greatest first 6 months of any president in history. As we know, Trump does love some truthful hyperbole, but they're arguing they've had victory after victory. What we know about politics, of course, is that that usually is followed by some great fall from grace, some disaster. And what'll be fascinating in the coming months and years, of course, is a second term president always fades and always loses momentum. We'll see what happens in the midterm elections. Democrats might win the House, get subpoena power, and then as he nears the end of his term, there'll be that sense of, Trump is a lame duck. He's yesterday's man. Where does the Republican Party and where does America go from here?
Yeah, what did Oswald Mosley say about political lives, that ultimately they all end in failure? So we haven't gotten there yet, obviously, but it's always that lingering dark cloud out there somewhere. David, as always, it's a delight, an absolute delight to talk with you. Get some sleep, safe travels back from Des Moines, and we'll talk again as the year moves on and we get a firmer fix on how well or badly all those things happen. And I hope you have a good 4th of July. I know you got a foot in both camps on that story, but
Indeed. Yeah. Happy 4th of July. Thank you.
right, you take care of yourself and be safe.
Cheers. All the best.
And Craig, are we going to take a station break?
This is the Deep Dive with Brooke Spector.
And we are back. Unfortunately, my second guest, we're having some technical troubles getting connected to that person. In the meantime, let me just do my necessary obligatory efforts here on behalf of our sponsors and partners. Attention, small business owners, boost your brand with an unbeatable advertising deal on 101.9 High FM. Get 5 ads per day for 5 days for just 5,000 Rand. The stimulus campaign is perfect for businesses looking to make a splash. Don't miss out on this exclusive opportunity to reach your audience and grow your business. Interested? Email info@highfm.com or text 061-895-1019 today. And one further message to bring to your attention, the Kolel Bookshop, just a second here, Mike, there we go. The Kolel Bookshop annual sales here is once again this year, Let's start that again for you. Live radio is exciting. The Kaleo Bookshop annual sales is here once again. This year, all our products, such as Sefarim books on all subjects, Judaica, and giftware, are all at a discount of 25%. We are also focusing on sets of art scroll books. Please look at the catalog online, place your orders with payment at the discounted price, and we will arrange shipment to South Africa to fulfill your needs. Take advantage during the period of the sale from the 22nd of June to July 6th. See you at the Kolel Bookshop. In the absence of our second guest, I just wanted to do some reminiscing about the 4th of July. In many ways, the 4th of July is one of America's two main secular, nonpartisan, non-religious holidays that almost everybody feels bound to in America. The other, of course, is Thanksgiving Day, in which people get to eat a meal that the humorist Art Buchwald once said, it's the only day of the year that Americans eat at least as well as the French do every day of their lives. It features inevitably a roast turkey. It features all kinds of vegetable dishes. It features stuffing and gravy for the turkey. And if you've only had turkey in buffets in South Africa, you don't know what you're missing. There are ways to cook turkey that makes it an absolutely scrumptious meal. I have a secret recipe, and as we get closer to Thanksgiving, I will reveal it. But the 4th of July celebrates the independence declaration of the United States from its colonial overseers, the British. And of course, it was the declaration rather than the actual achievement. And in fact, it doesn't even fall on the right day, and that's one of the interesting things. The vote in the Continental Congress in Philadelphia in 1776 actually took place on the 2nd of July, and they only confirmed it by printing it and then distributing the information slowly. There was no internet, obviously, 249 years ago, but it was posted in its printed form in taverns, in pubs, in meeting houses, in churches, all over those 13 colonies. And John Adams, who was one of the drafters of the Declaration of Independence, he and Thomas Jefferson and Benjamin Franklin and two others who had minor roles in that affair, wrote that document in a very hot, steamy, sticky Philadelphia hotel room over 2 days, brought it back to the Congress where they debated it and issued it. And Adams wrote to his wife, Abigail. They had a lively correspondence throughout their lives, even though they didn't have the internet, even though there were no post offices as we know them today, there was no postnet or courier service. They wrote letters back and forth to each other. And on the 3rd of July, Adams wrote to his wife and said that they have achieved something extraordinary and it should be celebrated with solemn proclamations, but also games and festivals and feasts and all manner of entertainments to celebrate this endeavor. And then he closed with the more somber note saying, but of course, we now actually have to do the thing rather than simply, you know, celebrate the fact that we've said we're going to do it. That was 249 years ago, give or take a day or two. And today in America, people will, as they have ever since, gather for barbecues, otherwise known as braais. They've had parades, usually in a jovial, happy setting rather than a militaristic kind of thing. And then they would gather, often in a public park, and wait for the twilight to become dark. And then there would be inevitably the fireworks. And Americans, of course, don't usually have fireworks on New Year's Eve because it's freezing cold and nobody wants to sit outside and watch the fireworks. Instead, they watch that large crystal ball descend from Times Square and they have a party and wish each other Happy New Year. But on the 4th of July, they sit outside, they gaze up into the sky, and they wonder at the possibilities. Next year is the 250th anniversary, and at that point, the country will be facing a midterm election. There will be the unresolved, I suspect, issues of still the war in Ukraine. The Middle East will continue to have its difficulties, large and small. There will be other trouble spots in the world. We'll know whether or not Donald Trump's one big, beautiful bill is having a salutary or difficult impact on the American economy. And we will begin to think long and hard as Americans about the nature of the country and its forward trajectory, where it will be in the years ahead. Will it still be able to maintain its preeminent position in the world, or will it deal with challenges in a way which is effective and successful from countries like China? Or will it have to accept the fact that its sun is not rising, but perhaps starting to set? And those will be questions that are going to preoccupy politicians and thinkers and writers, but also average and ordinary citizens as they go about their day. But regardless, to Americans who may be listening to this broadcast in South Africa or perhaps around the world, let me extend my own personal feeling of a happy new, a happy 4th of July. Enjoy the events that you may participate in, and think about the way in which the country should begin to gather itself for the future. For South Africans, of course, we go about our business quite normally on this day. There are all manner of challenges and problems in this country as well. But the country, South Africa's celebrations of its changes, its change in regime, its ability to become a better nation for all its citizens, is still a question that occupies everyone's mind and is something that everyone must put their energies and efforts into making true rather than simply hopeful. But I think the bottom line for me is that the 4th of July is always a holiday of aspiration, what we would like to see happen, what we would like to see the country become, and how it might fulfill the promises that were first enumerated in its Declaration of Independence, which said, all men are created equal. They are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, among them the pursuit of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You know, one of the most ironic things that I ever discovered when I was doing research for a course I was teaching, and I'll finish, we'll close off our broadcast, is those very same words showed up in the Declaration of Independence of Vietnam in 1945, written by none other than, he quoted the American Declaration of Independence directly and said that, in his view, the rights ascribed to Americans are ascribed to all mankind. And on that unusual way of describing things, let me close my broadcast for today, and we'll go to a final closing ad break, and then we'll be happy to pass the microphone on to the next program, the next speaker, the next project at High FM. Thank you for listening, and we'll be back again next week with another broadcast on a different topic. And if you missed this whole broadcast or you have friends who would like to hear it, remind them, please. It's repeated on Sunday at 10 o'clock.